This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's so discouraging when you pick out a beautiful-looking peach or apple that turns out to be tasteless. The new book, How to Pick a Peach, by my guest Russ Parsons, explains how breeders have often sacrificed taste in order to develop fruits and vegetables that can withstand the long journey from the farm to the supermarket. Parsons' book also offers advice on selecting, storing, and preparing fruits and vegetables. He's a food and wine columnist for the LA Times. Russ Parsons, welcome back to Fresh Air. So what do you think is the fruit or vegetable that has suffered the most lately as a result of being bred to withstand long-distance shipping? Let's eliminate the tomato, because we have sung the woes of the tomato for many years now. So come up with a different answer.
Oh, besides, I can't do tomatoes? Well, I'd say probably right off the top of my head, I would say strawberries. Because the strawberry in its natural state is a very, very fragile piece of fruit. But as a fragile piece of fruit, especially when it's ripe, you can't take it in your truck very far. And so in trying to improve the strawberry so that it could be shipped to New York and Philadelphia and Florida, the plant breeders have made it more and more resilient, to the point now where, you know, you've got strawberries that when you try and crush them with a fork, it'll actually bend the fork. You know, they're defensive strawberries. And there's a funny story. Years ago, I wanted to do something with Fraise Dubois, which is kind of the original wild strawberry. They're very tiny. They're extremely, extremely fragrant. Very, very delicate. I finally found somebody who would sell them to me, or who had them, and I called him to ask him if he would sell them to me. And he said, well, you know, I do have them, but no, I won't sell them to you. And I said, well, you know, I'm happy to pay for them. And he said, no, I can't sell them to you because they'll never arrive in any kind of shape if I ship them to you. And I said, oh, you know, look, I'll pay whatever the shipping costs to have them overnighted. I'll do, you know, we went through this long negotiation. And finally, I think just to get me off the phone, he said, okay, look, I'm going to ship them to you, but I'm not going to take any responsibility for what they are when they arrive. So the next day, overnighted, I got this huge box. And I opened up the box, and inside of it were, you know, all these packing peanuts. And inside that was another box. So I opened up the other box. It's like one of those Russian dolls. At the very center of it, there was this little, like a pint case. I opened up the pint case, and there was like the most fragrant strawberry jam that I had ever smelled. But even with all of those protective measures, that strawberry could not be shipped. So that's the kind of compromises that have had to be made to ensure that people can have whatever they want whenever they want it.
So is there a hearty and strong but still tasty strawberry that you recommend?
Not really. I think the best thing that you can say for strawberries is that they're one of the most widely planted crops around. I mean, they're one of the most popular farmers market fruits. And that's generally a pretty good indication of when something has really been ruined by commercial agriculture, is that they really show up at farmers markets. And farmers market farmers have the advantage of being able to plant strawberries that don't need to withstand all of that shipping. You can't really blame the farmers here in California. California produces something like 90% of all of the strawberries, but you can't really blame those farmers because they've got customers all over the country who want their strawberries. And so, you know, either they're going to be like my cranky guy and say, no, I'm sorry, I'm just not going to sell them to you, or they begin making these kinds of compromises. But at farmers markets, the farmers aren't constrained by that, because they're not having to ship it across country or even necessarily across town. So they can grow varieties that have really high flavor and really high perfume and not worry so much about the strawberry jam factor.
Now, in writing about cherries, you refer to the cherry apocalypse. Why? what justifies such a strong term in describing the state of cherries?
Well, what happened with cherries is another one of those kind of emblematic things. At the turn of the century, New York was a major cherry-producing state. In fact, there's a famous fruit historian named U.P. Hedrick, who I believe it was in the 20s, produced this amazing kind of an Audubon's guide to the cherries of New York. That's actually what it's called, with all these beautiful full-color plates. I think there were 200 varieties of sour cherries alone. But what happened was, New York's a really difficult place to raise fruit because the summers are really hot and they're really humid. And that leads to all kinds of funguses and diseases and breakdowns. The cherry industry, the cherry farmers, eventually moved to the eastern slopes of Washington and Oregon, where the summers are really hot and really dry, and so they ripen much better with much less chance of disease. But in that transition, the possible field of cherries got narrowed. The possible field of cherry varieties got narrowed, to the point where right now the Bing cherry, which actually is an antique variety, and it's a very good cherry when it's grown well, accounts for more than 2/3 of all of the cherries that are grown in the United States. But that's just one variety, as opposed to 300 or 400 different kinds of varieties that have fallen by the wayside.
So if you go to a supermarket and buy cherries, it's most likely you're buying Bing.
If you go to the supermarket and you buy a red cherry, it's a Bing. And if you buy one of those blushing cherries, you know, the kind of golden red ones, it's a Rainier. So we're essentially now a two cherry system.
Now, I feel guilty. I didn't let you talk about tomatoes when I asked you about the food that has suffered most because it's been bred for long distance shipping. And I feel like we should respect the tomato and talk about how it's changed over time for better and for worse. So, I mean, we've all tasted those cardboardy, pulpy, tasteless tomatoes. Have they improved since then, the ones that are shipped?
You know, actually, I think they have. And this is just over the last, maybe even the last 5 years. Tomatoes are almost like a poster child for what can go right with produce. And to illustrate that, you know, think back to maybe 10 years ago. The kinds of tomatoes that you found in the market. You found the mature green, you found a vine ripe, and you probably had cherry tomatoes. So there's like three tomatoes there in the produce department. This summer, if you walk into any kind of produce department, any kind of upscale high-end produce department, there will be 25 different kinds of tomatoes that are available for there'll be different varieties of heirlooms, there will be different stages of ripenesses, there will be different colors, different shapes, all different kinds of tomatoes. Now, I'm not going to say that these tomatoes are going to be as good as that backyard tomato that you remember picking from the plant at dead ripeness and eating on your back step. That can't be reproduced very easily in commercial agriculture. You can get those sometimes at farmers markets, but even at farmers markets, not always. The really surprising thing about all of these changes in tomatoes, though, is that this tomato revolution was started by the Dutch and by Canadians. And the thing that really broke that kind of the tomato Antarctic was when the Dutch began importing different varieties of tomatoes into the United States in the early 90s. And people went berserk for them because there were greenhouse tomatoes. They were different varieties, different shapes. Sometimes they were the tomatoes that grow, you know, that they clip and they sell the entire vine with it. That gives you that really wonderful tomato smell, even if it doesn't translate necessarily to the tomato. And people went crazy for them. And the American tomato growers went into basically almost a decade-long slump trying to recover.
So what changed? Why are there more varieties of mass-grown American tomatoes?
Supermarkets, for all of their faults, are an incredibly competitive industry. I mean, these guys work on like a 1.5% profit margin. And the produce department is one of the main magnets for a supermarket. When people decide which supermarket they're going to go to, it's the produce department often that determines which one they're going to go to. And the produce managers found that, you know, oddly enough, people like having choices. And the funny thing is, when they would offer, you know, 8 or 9 different kinds of tomatoes at the beginning, when they were getting their toes wet, all of those tomatoes might not have sold out, but overall sales of tomatoes increased. So people like going someplace and feeling like they're having choices and that they're being able to, they like to feel like they're seeing exotic things or different things. It builds interest. It builds excitement. And so the produce managers were very quick to jump on the bandwagon.
Let me ask you about something that I think has gone wrong. I have found that I frequently buy bananas that never ripen. I mean, you can keep them out for however you want, and they'll turn maybe to this kind of like unconvincing shade of yellow, not a full yellow. and, you know,
a reluctant yellow.
Reluctant yellow. Yeah, and like they're just never going to taste good. And at the best, instead of tasting kind of sweet, they'll taste kind of like earthy and a little bitter.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on?
Well, bananas are what botanists call climacteric fruits. And that's along with tomatoes, with peaches. These are fruits that will continue ripening after they've been picked. But it's important to remember that there's a difference between maturity and ripeness. Maturity is when what happens on the tree, when the plant is gathering all of the nutrients and all of the sugars and all of that stuff that is going to make the building blocks for flavor. Ripeness, it can also happen off of the tree with climacteric fruits. And it's all of those things that turn something from being simply sweet and sour to complex and flavorful. And there's physical softening that is involved in it, and the physical softening leads to the building of more complex flavors and aromas and all of the deliciousness. But if something is picked before it's fully mature, it's never going to ripen to any kind of satisfactory state. And I think that's what's happening with those bananas. They keep pushing them earlier and earlier and earlier. And from the farmer's point of view, you know, being the let's look at both sides of the story kind of guy. From the farmer's point of view, every time a piece of fruit is left hanging on the tree, every day that it's left hanging is an opportunity for something bad to happen. Something good happens because it's developing flavor, but that good thing doesn't quite translate as much to the farmer as the risk of losing a crop because something bad happens. So they keep pushing the harvest earlier and earlier and earlier, hoping that they're, you know, just kind of for safety's sake. And I think that a lot of times they push them to the point where the fruit never ripens to any kind of satisfactory state.
Now, how am I supposed to know which bananas were picked prematurely and will never satisfactorily ripen?
Bananas are really, really hard. I don't think there is a really satisfactory answer for it. And bananas are one of those, the story of the banana is one of those amazing produce legends because bananas don't grow commercially in the United States. But the banana is the number one produce item in terms of quantities sold. So it's all of our bananas are imported, most of them from Central America. And, you know, it's probably one of those things that, I hate to say it, but it's probably one of those things that in a perfect world we wouldn't be eating.
Don't say that.
I eat them. I think if you have consistent bad luck with bananas at one store, it may be time to change stores.
Let's talk a little bit about the world of apples. Now, when I was growing up, I don't know, there was like the Macintosh apple and the Golden Delicious apple and, you know, a couple of other kinds of apples. But now, like, God, there's just, like, dozens of them. And
there's all these new names. It's like there's this long-running television series, and they've killed off all the regulars, and there's a completely new cast, you know? It sounds like maybe a David Chase series or something like that.
No, there's, like, the Jonah Golden, the Pink Lady, and the Fuji, and the Gala. And I mean, I never heard of these growing up.
No. In fact, most of these were introduced from the mid-70s on and even into the 80s. What happened was that the American apple industry, which is mainly in Washington and to a certain extent in Oregon, had really concentrated on a few varieties, primarily Red and Golden Delicious. Red Delicious had been bred to the point where it was no longer delicious. In fact, it was no longer even really acceptable. It's this funny thing. The thing that makes Red Delicious red, the pigment on the skin, also makes it bitter. And so they kept trying to breed the fruit to be redder and redder and redder to try and, you know, because people love to buy red apples. But the redder they got it, the more bitter the apple became. Until finally people just said, the heck with it. You know, I'm not eating these anymore. At the same time, they had really pushed to sell fruit in Asia. And they were really not having much success with these varieties. So they started planting test plots of varieties that had been developed in the Southern Hemisphere or in Asia, hence the names like Fuji, and sell, to sell in the Asian markets, because the Asian market has been a huge motivator for produce sales in the last 20 years because there's so much money to be made there.
Are our Fuji apples now coming from Asia, or have Americans started growing Fujis?
No, they were developed in Asia, and they planted them in America to sell back to Asia. Well, what they found was that these were actually really good apples. And so, and when they would have extras, they would sell them on the American market, and people were happy to get them. It was a welcome change from the old Red Delicious. Now, the Golden Delicious is an old American variety, and when that's harvested right, that can be a really good apple. But it's important to remember that a Golden Delicious is actually golden; it's not green. Almost all the time, you see them green in the market.
You have a lot of advice regarding what kind of foods to refrigerate and what fruit and produce to never refrigerate. What are some of the fruits and vegetables that you should just never refrigerate?
Never refrigerate. I mean, remember the old rhyme, you never refrigerate bananas. Don't put your bananas in the refrigerator. They won't ripen. Potatoes are a weird one. Like if you refrigerate a potato, the enzymes in the potato begin converting the starch to sugar. Because it's just the plant getting ready to produce new shoots, and that happens at various rates with different varieties. But if you put a baking potato in the refrigerator for 2 or 3 days, when you bake it, it's got this weird sweet quality to it that's really odd. Probably the single biggest mistake that people make, though, is tomatoes. You should never refrigerate a tomato. Refrigerating a tomato drastically reduces the flavor of the tomato. It'll really ruin it. And at no time should you refrigerate a tomato. I mean, if you've got a tomato that's on the counter and it's ready to turn into that kind of tomato puddle thing, then you've got to refrigerate it, obviously, because otherwise you're going to throw it away. But you have to recognize that you're going to really affect the flavor of it. Peaches are somewhat like that, actually. If you've ever bitten into a peach and it was kind of mealy and dry and it looked great, but there was just no flavor, that's probably chill damage. And it's this very weird thing that happens between like 35 and 45 degrees. They can be kept colder than that and they'll be fine. They can be kept warmer than that and they'll be fine. But if you refrigerate an unripe peach between those two temperatures, it completely ruins the texture and the flavor. So with peaches and nectarines, you want to leave them on the counter until they begin to ripen. You know, that thing of the difference between ripening and maturing, so that they're beginning to soften and they're beginning to smell really good. Then you can put them in the refrigerator and they'll be fine. But if you put them in too early, you're ruining that peach.
Is summer your favorite eating season?
Oh, you know, the thing is, all of them are. So often when people talk about eating seasonally, it's like it's a prescription, or it's a punishment, or it's something that you're doing for the good of the planet, or because, you know, for various ideological reasons. For me, eating with a season is kind of a way of not getting bored. You know, you go from winter with great winter squashes and citrus and greens and cooking greens and that kind of thing. Go to spring with artichokes and strawberries and asparagus. Then to summer with peaches and tomatoes and eggplants and peppers. And you know, in fall, each season has its stars. And part of the fun of eating for me is that kind of part of it is delayed gratification. You know, sometimes you think, oh, I'd really like to have a peach now. You think, well, you know, I could have an adequate peach now, or a barely adequate peach now, or I can have a great piece of citrus, or I can have a great tangerine or grapefruit or something like that. So part of it's when they really come in, they taste so great, it's amazing. But part of it also is that, you know, it's a big wide world that we live in, and especially in produce, and it's full of pleasures. And I think we ought to kind of explore as many of them as possible and not kind of get narrowed down to the two or three things that we really like.
Well, Russ Parsons, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Russ Parsons is the author of the new book, How to Pick a Peach. He's a food and wine columnist for the LA Times. You can read an excerpt of his book on our website, freshair.npr.org.